Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University have edited the genes of human embryos using the new technology CRISPR. It's believed to be the first time this has been attempted in the United States.
This breakthrough raises a number of medical and bioethical questions. What impact could this technology have on health? Will it become widely requested? And who will have access to it?
Dr. Wendy Chung joins us now. She's a geneticist and the Kennedy Family Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Columbia University. Dr. Chung, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, the technology that we're talking about today, it's a part of the gene editing technique using CRISPR. Can you tell us what CRISPR is and how it works?
Sure. It's a methodology that can be used to alter the genetic information in a very precise way, to be able to, if you will, go in and edit a gene, whether it's a gene with a problem and bring it back into what the normal sequence is, or potentially to be able to change that gene and enhance it in some way.
And I understand that it's surprisingly simple to use this technology, not necessarily the way it's been used in Oregon, but that the technology itself is not as complicated as you might think.
Sure. So it's something that's now been, I'll use the word scalable. So it's used in many, many laboratories, literally hundreds of laboratories around the U.S. as well as internationally. It's quite precise, much more precise than our old methods of altering genes were. So what I mean by that is it's able to very surgically go in and alter a specific gene at a specific location with less effect in terms of what we call off-target effects or having sort of collateral damage, if you will, in terms of altering other genes. And that's part of the great promise of using this technology in the future for genetic conditions.
When you talk about the great promise, can you tell us what the goal is, what the big dreams are of science when we talk about using gene editing?
Well, certainly not just in the case of altering embryos, but generally we're becoming much more we understand much better the human genome and what genes are associated with diseases and specifically, where those different changes are, those mutations. But that's just the first step. It's the big first step in terms of knowing what to focus on and where to target. But one of the hopes that many both families or individuals with genetic conditions and many doctors like myself have is that if we did have technology to be able to return those genes to normalcy, that we might be able to restore the function, be able to make people healthy that would be either predisposed or already have these genetic conditions. And might be able to do it with a very common tool, almost like a gene scalpel. We wouldn't have to create new pills or new therapies for every single disease. There would be one sort of sweeping way of being able to treat these conditions. So that's the hope just in general about using the technology. For this group, it's also about, thinking about, is there, can you do this literally almost from the point of conception? So can you do this so early on that you fix this in a permanent way and be able to do it, even before the embryo or the fetus starts developing?
How big a deal would you say this news is from Oregon Health and Science University, the editing using CRISPR of a human embryo? What does this represent?
Well, it's not the first time it's been done. This has been done before in China. I think we learned from that experiment that it wasn't quite as precise as any of us would have liked. There were some things that were what we call off-target effects, and that's sobering because in the early days of gene therapy that used some other, if you will, scalpels that weren't quite as precise, we know that several of the individuals that were part of those studies actually died as a result of those studies. Some of them developed leukemia. Some of them died even literally days after the procedure was started. So it's not a benign treatment that we're trying here in these early sort of days. And so we have to be very cautious and very careful that we're not trading essentially one disease or one condition for another that might ultimately be fatal. So the studies that were done in China, number one, taught us in terms of from a safety point of view, we need to be careful and do this, in a stepwise fashion. This clearly is not going to cure these genetic diseases overnight. But the other part of this is that, scientists have been discussing this with the public because it very much needs to be a discussion in the public square in terms of whether or not this is something, for instance, that we should be not just fixing, if you will, heart cells or brain cells or kidney cells, but literally, fix what would be passed on from generation to generation, what we call the germline. And that has bigger implications because then if you change something, it's not just affecting that person, but it's affecting potentially generations to come. And this could be either in terms of fixing a gene for kidney disease or heart disease, but it could also be enhancements. So it could be things in terms of making a stronger athlete, making someone who's faster or taller or has different hair color or eye color. So I think we need to think very carefully about that and, you know, again, have the discourse in terms of if we want to set any limits in terms of what this should or shouldn't be used for.
We're talking with Dr. Wendy Chung right now, professor of pediatrics and medicine at Columbia University, talking about news that researchers in Oregon have been able to use gene editing technology, the CRISPR technology, on embryos for the first time in the United States. I should say that these are human embryos. And Dr. Chung, you talked about the debate and some of the questions being raised, and you said this needs to happen in the public square because these are big questions that could have far-reaching consequences. How do we go about having this discussion?
Well, I think it starts with what you're doing right now, which is fantastic. The public needs to hopefully get the facts in terms of what can be done, what can't be done, to realize, you know, what the potential implications for this are in the long term and to be forward thinking of that, because small steps now could mean big steps in the future. I do think, you know, leveraged on the one hand are that there are an awful lot of people with, in many cases, very rare genetic conditions that are searching very desperately to find cures and find answers and to be able to hope that the next generation won't have to deal with some of the conditions their children and family members had. So on the one hand, this, you know, has great, great promise and great potential. And so for many individuals, they've thought about using this in circumscribed, very specific indications or reasons. But on the other hand, it's somewhat of a slippery slope. How burdensome is a disease? What's the difference between a disease and simply differences between one individual or another? Take something like autism. Many people would say that autism is simply a difference, from one person to another and how the brain works. And many people with autism are brilliant, incredibly gifted. And, you know, we shouldn't be stifling that or trying to get rid of genes that would predispose people like that. On the other hand, there are certain people, autism is a spectrum. There are certain people who have autism that, you know, they can't speak. They have seizures. They have many other health issues. And, you know, many parents feel that that's a significant burden for them. So, you know, it's a discussion we have to have. You know, where do you draw that line, as I said, between what's a disease, what's just a normal difference, and what's sort of enough, what's impactful enough that we should go to such extremes to be able to start altering our human genes.
And what about the embryos themselves that are used in this research? What can you tell us about them and any concerns about the ethics using human embryos?
Well, certainly there are many people that have concerns, you know, that would consider an embryo a potential life and something that, you know, is quite sacred. This could grow up to be a person, you know, like you or I. And in terms of couples that are desperately seeking to have a child, you know, this could be important in terms of their future. There are certainly many embryos that are generated for couples that are going through assisted reproduction. So there are, if you will, extra embryos that right now are either being discarded it is the choice of that couple to discard them or donating them for research. But it is, again, I think an individual interpretation about, is that a life? Is it a potential life? Is that sacred? You know, what can be done with that? Right now, from a legal point of view, research can be done on human embryos. But again, it's something that as a society, we need to think about what limits we might want to put on that.
It's my understanding that the embryos in this particular experiment, in this work, were not embryos that would have been able to be viable, to be carried to term. Is that your understanding?
Well, it is true that in terms of many of the embryos that are generated through in vitro fertilization, many of them will not survive. They have, if you will, other problems. They are trying to, if you will, recycle in terms of the products. But again, you know, there are some people that would say even if in circumstances, you know, that is a potential life, even if it might be a different potential life. And, you know, some people would say they just shouldn't be used, period.
What kind of concerns do you see about whether this becomes a class issue, whether there could be a society of have and have nots, not only maybe the children who have the benefit of living maybe without a disorder they might otherwise have had, but what if we get into the designer realm of babies, and what if that's only available to people with a lot of money, if insurance, say, wouldn't cover it typically? What do you think about those areas?
Absolutely. So I think that's one of the most important questions to think about from an ethical point of view and a access to care or access to resources point of view. So if you think about it, and I'm just going to use one example. So that's very public. You know, Angelina Jolie has in her family a hereditary breast cancer gene. And I'm not making any specific comments about her, but just to say it's an example that some people are familiar with. There are people who might say, well, you know what, I'd like to be able to prune my family tree and make sure that future generations don't have to worry about an increased risk of breast or ovarian cancer. On the other hand, that's not something that's, you know, has to be a life-threatening problem. You know, we have ways of being able to prevent cancer. I take my hat off to Ms. Jolie in particular because she took measures to be able to minimize her risk of future cancer. So there are interventions that are quite effective, but, you know, they're not trivial. You know, they can require, or in some cases women choose to remove their breasts or remove their ovaries that are healthy, and that can be a very big, impactful thing. So, you know, you could say, well, you know, I could just very easily snip out that bad gene from my genome and I could replace it with a good gene, and then I don't have to worry about it, you know, for all of my daughters or my granddaughters or anyone else in the family. On the other hand, going through this technology, and there's sort of a step forward from that today, which we call in vitro fertilization with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So in this case, it's not actually editing the genes. It's not changing the genes, but it is selecting among a group of embryos the ones that genetically don't have the predisposition to that genetic condition. So that's a technology that's already available today. It doesn't involve tinkering with the genes. It doesn't involve necessarily destroying any of the embryos. So I think most people feel ethically that that's, you know, a viable option right now. But I'll just say that right now, that's something that's not commonly covered by insurance. That's oftentimes, depending on where you live, $20,000 to $30,000 per cycle to be able to do that. And already there is a group of have and have nots in terms of who can use that technology for anything that might be as impactful as Tay-Sachs disease, the disease that results in children that will almost certainly die of a very severe neurological condition in the first few years of life, to couples that use it for things like, BRCA, BRCA1 or 2. And, you know, beyond that, beyond just correcting what people would say an egregious disease genes, there's the idea of enhancement. You know, so could you do this to, as I was saying before, potentially select for, you know, someone who might be taller, someone who might be shorter, depending on what you prefer, someone who might be more intelligent, more outgoing, might be more athletic, you know, whatever those characteristics are, where I would say are differences in normal, you know, no one is good or bad, they are just differences, but being able to select for that in a positive, or, you know, what some people call those designer babies or enhancement. And surely that's something that, you know, I guess is not going to be covered by insurance to do this, will be, you know, something that people will have to pay out of pocket to do it. And so will there be different classes of individuals, you know, people that can have not only children who are free of disease, but might be super in some way? And will it also set up then differences in terms of disabilities? Will people in society think about individuals who are disabled or have differences that have an impact on their health? Will they think of them differently? Will they say, you know, well, your parents weren't responsible enough to be able to have healthy children, they had you? Will it, you know, change in terms of any access to educational opportunities, employment opportunities, housing, you know, anything like that?
We're talking with Dr. Wendy Chung right now. She's the Kennedy Family Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Columbia University. With us now to talk about the news that researchers in Oregon have been able to use gene editing technology on human embryos for the first time in the United States.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of researchers using this technology? Do you think that people should have the option to use gene editing on their embryos? Or do you think nature should take its course? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about the potential benefits and the bioethical concerns about using gene editing technology on embryos. Researchers in Oregon just became the first in the United States to use this technology on human embryos. We're talking with Dr. Wendy Chung right now. She's a professor of pediatrics and medicine at Columbia University.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this gene editing technology? And do you think that you would use this technology to alter genes if there's some kind of condition in your family that you would prefer not be passed down? What impact do you think this could have on medicine? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Dr. Chung, we talked earlier about the potential for this sort of gene editing technology. What about the limitations?
Well, certainly the limitation, as I said, is it's very early days. Although I would like to say that we can, like I said, with like a scalpel go in and make a very specific change, there are some limitations. Sometimes we do make that change in embryo. We make it in one cell, but it's not present in all of the cells, so we haven't completely fixed all of the cells within that. There may be circumstances in which we think we fixed it, but we've actually made some other edit someplace else within the genome, someplace else in the genetic information that could have other impacts in terms of health or longevity. So it clearly we need to study it, not just in humans, but if one is going to try this in terms of very careful studies, being able to see long-term what the outcomes are and do this also in things besides humans first, being able to do it in other mammals and other organisms.
Right. And this is, as you said, it's early on and in the United States, a first step on human embryos. What are the next steps specifically that get us towards some of those loftier goals that we have down the road?
Well, I do think not just doing it in embryos, but there are many, many researchers who are thinking about doing gene editing within what we call somatic cells, or in other words, not starting out with the developing embryo, but thinking about can you do this in blood cells, for instance, for a person who has a blood disorder, take those cells out of the body, fix them, put them back into the body of the individual. So I think there are many researchers already working on that now that will cure individuals who right now already suffer from and have those conditions. I think there's going to be a lot of work done on that to be able to, as I said, first in whether they're mice or other animals, non-human primates, to be able to see does that effect last? Are there any other unexpected implications or repercussions from doing that? I think a lot more of that's going to be done well before we get to the point of doing this in embryos that might ultimately, you know, lead to humans, you know, actual developed humans. So, and there's a lot of promise for it, for using it to cure human diseases and being able to take care of people who are already with us, much less the next generation.
Among scientists, I imagine that the concerns might be slightly different than the public at large or among politicians. Among scientists, what do you see as the biggest stumbling blocks?
Well, I think among scientists, number one is, I think, you know, a lot of scientists can get creative, and I think that's a wonderful thing to be able to think about how to solve problems in new ways. The public actually has an impact on science, though, in terms of determining scientific funding. So whether it's monies that come from the National Institutes of Health or National Science Foundation, the public discourse does shape what we do in science, in the sense of you have to have money to be able to develop these technologies, do the experiments that are necessary. And I think it's very important to, as I said, as a society, decide what's in bounds and out of bounds in terms of where we want this to go. You know, I think, like I said, some of us, I think, have concerns about using it for things that, you know, are, I would say, more trivial in terms of enhancement, that the risks are greater than the potential benefits from doing that, and that sometimes scientists try and, you know, get ahead of themselves. They may be overly confident in terms of what they can do and predict, and we certainly don't want to do anything that's going to put the future generation at risk.
How far off is this technology? It seems like it's moving quickly, but in reality, how far off? I mean, it's a guess at this point, but how far do you think we are from being able to, say, remove a gene that would predispose someone to breast cancer?
Well, I think from a very technical point of view, this can be done today. I mean, in terms of just literally doing the gene editing, designing what we call the guide RNAs, being able to do the CRISPR-Cas9 experiments and being able to, if you will, snip out and correct that gene. That, as I said, is done every day in laboratories across the United States and around the world. I think doing it specifically in the circumstance of an embryo, just at the very first second cell stage, doing it at that stage is something, obviously, this is, really monumental in terms of doing it in the United States specifically. But being able to do all the follow-on experiments are necessary to demonstrate the safety and efficacy of that. None of that has been done whatsoever. And, it's challenging because when you think about this, you don't just want to say 9 months of outcome data to see, that a baby goes born from this. You want to be looking well into the future, being able to let whatever it is that has this gene therapy, let it age up, let it live a full life course, and be able to see what those, long-term, are there any other unexpected consequences from this?
So a lot of ground to cover there. Dr. Chung, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Wendy Chung, Kennedy Family Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Columbia University.